This is episode 341 with Mark Pollina, 18-time finisher of the Boston Marathon as a bandit, charity runner, and a sub-3-hour qualifier, plus the author of the new book, The Boston Marathon Handbook. Welcome to the Strength Running Podcast. I'm your host, Coach Jason Fitzgerald, and my singular goal is to help you improve your running by getting stronger, racing faster, preventing more injuries, and achieving more of your goals. I'm a monthly columnist for Trail Runner Magazine, a 239 marathoner, and author of the Performance Training Journal, now on Amazon. You can learn more about me and strength running at strengthrunning.com. If you enjoy this show, please support our partners who are offering you some great deals on amazing products that are going to help your performances and overall health. First is my favorite way to hydrate, Element. Element is a delicious, sugar-free, high-sodium electrolyte mix. I love this stuff because it's perfect for endurance runners who are sweating a lot, drinking a lot of water like we all do, and because of that, we can be susceptible to electrolyte imbalances. If you happen to have a high sweat rate, or if you're like me and just have very salty sweat, you're going to want all 1,000 milligrams of sodium included in Element. Electrolytes play a key role in helping you avoid dehydration, dizziness, cramps, and tiredness, especially after long runs or workouts. And Element is used by the military, law enforcement, professional sports teams, and they're the official hydration partner of Team USA Weightlifting. Get your free sample pack with any purchase at drinklmnt.com/strengthrunning, and they'll let you try every flavor. That's drinklmnt.com/strengthrunning for your free sample pack. Next is Prevenex, the only supplement company I trust. And Prevenex has recently made a big announcement. They've released their new product, Muscle Health Plus, a combination of creatine, branch chain, and essential amino acids, as well as ingredients to aid protein synthesis and absorption. This is your anti-soreness supplement. Use code JASON15 for 15% off your first order at Prevenex.com. Now, if you're a master's runner, you want to build some muscle, or you're just particularly injury prone, Muscle Health Plus will help you hold on to your muscle and rebound faster from workouts and long runs. See all the details at Prevenex.com. And be sure to use code JASON15 to save 15% off your first purchase. My guest today is gearing up for his 19th Boston Marathon. Mark Pollina has run 26 marathons in total and has been a regular fixture at Boston as a bandit many years ago, a charity runner, and a sub-3-hour qualifier. He's just written a new book called The Boston Marathon Handbook that is now available. There's a link in the show description if you want to check it out. Mark and I are predictably going to talk a lot about the Boston Marathon today. He has a very helpful way of segmenting the course and chunking it into a very course-specific strategy that is surely going to help you have a better race in April. And with this many years of experience at the Boston Marathon, he's seen it all. He's had good races and bad races, so he knows how to navigate the athlete's village, getting to the athlete's village in the first place, and how to run an excellent Boston Marathon. And even if you're not running Boston, I hope this episode inspires you to put it on your bucket list. There is indeed something special about the Boston Marathon. Without further delay, please enjoy my conversation with Mark Pollina. Yeah, I mean, this is amazing. I mean, you've made the Boston Marathon such a big part of your life over the last almost 20 years. You're gearing up for your 19th, right?
Right. So it'll be my 19th. But you know, what's funny is around in this town, I'm not abnormal. I really am not. I mean, yeah, I wrote the book on it, but I've met so many people in my travels, you know, just running the race as a qualifier and also as a charity runner, that I've run it 30 times or 35 times or more. So, the streets of Boston are littered with those kind of people.
Yeah, it sure is. It's such a big piece of the culture around Boston. And, you know, there's just something about the Boston Marathon. What makes you keep coming back to Boston? What makes this marathon so special that there are people out there like you who are gearing up for your 19th, but there's other people who have been run 30 Boston marathons or even more? There is something undeniably unique about Boston.
I would agree, you know, and around the world, just seeing different runners at the expo, they just speak with reverence about the race. It's one of the reasons I wanted to write the book. But, you know, I think, you know, for starters, definitely the history, right? So, you know, just to think that when you're going to take your left on Boylston, that you're going to run in the footsteps of Johnny Kelly and Des Linden and Bill Rogers is just a rush. It's just pretty, pretty crazy. So no doubt, I think the history, you know, is something that attracted me. When I first moved to Boston, I moved, unbeknownst to me, a few blocks away from Heartbreak Hill. And I got to know Heartbreak Hill before I realized it was Heartbreak Hill. And I was like, oh, it's just a polite little, hill in a town that you would never know is the most famous hill in all of road racing. So it just blew me away. But definitely the history for starters. But then I would say, you know, the camaraderie among the runners. So, you know, whether you are a Boston qualifier or a charity runner, that camaraderie is second to none in any race I've ever been to. Charity runners from different organizations run Boston every Saturday on the course. So they get to know one another. One of the first things that I did long ago was I ran with this group on Thursday afternoons. We'd take the T, which is the subway in Boston, out to this one stop right around mile 17 on the course. And then we would run back into town. And we would do it every Thursday night. And when we got back, we'd stop at either the Elliott Bar or a Crossroads Bar and have pizza and beer. And hundreds of runners would do that. And they would literally change in a phone booth size restroom to do that out of the work clothes, take the tea in the middle of the winter in, you know, blinding snow, and then run back into town. It was just crazy. But it was one of those cool things where you realize it was special in the moment. Like, we're crazy people. What are we doing? But it was so special that it was like just legendary. It's been going on for decades now. So there's that camaraderie among the charity runners. And then, of course, when you're in Hopkinton and you qualified, you're in your corral. Everybody with a bib similar to yours is standing next to you. Your journeys to get there might be different, but you share in this great thing that you qualified, right? And you're taking on this amazing race together. So there's that shared, you know, you just feel connected to everyone. I would say the third thing is the size of the town, quite frankly, right? I live in New York too. So I go back and forth from Boston to New York. I love the New York City Marathon. Actually, arguably my best race in 2016. But I would say, you know, Boston is just the perfect size where the entire city just gets into it. And the connection, the intimacy you have with the crowds are very knowledgeable. So the spectators have been there year after year after year. And if they haven't been there, then their families have been there. So everybody knows how important it is. And then you have this thing called Patriots Day. So it's not a Saturday race. It's not a Sunday race. As you know, it's a Monday race. So the entire weekend, you're meeting with all these different people. It's complete happenstance. So when I was putting together the book, I wanted to get a lot of people to contribute to the book. And my network isn't as vast as yours. So I only had so many people to go to. And I actually, complete serendipity, walked the streets of the expo last year and ran into, you know, Mike Wardian, Kara Goucher, Dathan Ritzenhain. The list goes on and on. I was literally stumbling across them because the entire town just has this magical aura, and it's just you don't get that. Not to say anything bad about New York, you just don't get that same feeling. It's really a feeling. So when I started running it in 2003, I ran it as a bandit, but that was kind of a cool thing back in the day. Frowned upon now. But then I became a charity runner and I was hooked, you know, absolutely hooked. I had no idea I was going to end up running, you know, soon to be 19. That's just crazy. I figured I'd run one or two or three and that'd be it. But here I am.
Yeah. So it's almost like new runners when they say, I always never really liked running, but then when I started, I just got hooked. It's so easy for runners to get hooked on the sport. And especially on a race like Boston, I think you did a great job talking about all the many, many things that make Boston so unique. And that really contributes to that feeling on race day. Do you think the qualifying standards contribute to that as well? Because there does seem to be a little bit of prestige, a little bit of extra difficulty layered on top of Boston, because You know, if you want to be a Boston qualifier, okay, now you actually have to run pretty fast. And that sort of lends itself to this mystique of Boston, this kind of all these things put Boston up on a little bit of a pedestal.
Absolutely. No doubt. I mean, you know, it started before the qualifying standards actually came to be, right? In 1970 or so is when they first started to do that. But even before that, it was like this prestigious, you know, arguably the most prestigious race in all of road racing, primarily due to its extensive history. But once they introduced the standards, oh yeah, I think that has definitely upped the mystique for sure. And it's interesting, you know, last year, as you may well know, or this year, I should say, you know, over 11,000 people who did qualify won't be running Boston because they didn't qualify with a, you know, time that was fast enough. So that's going to be more interesting going forward about what they do to address that. I don't know if that's the right, you know, excluding 10,000, 11,000 people in a given year doesn't seem quite right. Although, you know, people would argue that if you BQ'd and just everybody got in, that might be wrong too. it adds to that allure, if you will, of running Boston. Is you need to really bring out your absolute best, and sometimes you need to go beyond what you think is the BQ, because you know that other people are. So every second counts. You know, you always, as you know, you run a race and you think to yourself, well, I lost a second here, I lost a few seconds there. So you're analyzing your race. You need to do that in advance for Boston, right? Because you need to think, I need to BQ minus 5 minutes at least to get a shot. So yeah, it's, I think that definitely is an attraction that I'd hate to see go completely away.
Yeah, and I think for a lot of runners, they enjoy that. They enjoy the challenge. It kind of speaks to that a little bit more aggressive, competitive side to a lot of runners. But let's talk a little bit about those qualifying standards. You know, they are getting a little bit faster over time. I think the fastest times for the younger men and women are 3 hours and 3:30, respectively. But like you said, you usually have to actually beat the standard by a couple minutes. You mentioned 5 minutes is probably a really good buffer to have, just because there's so many people qualifying that, you know, they have just kind of logistical field size constraints. So, you know, do you have any strategies for runners who are on the cusp and they're trying to run their Boston qualifying marathon? How do they stack the odds in their favor when they're actually trying to qualify?
Wow. Okay. Good question. Yeah, I would say, you know, this is the strength running podcast. I would say that Boston, more than any course that I've run, really rewards strength. You know, where else can Yuki Kawaguchi, you know, beat every runner in the world? Well, he can do it at Boston in 2018 when they had 30 mile an hour headwinds and, you know, torrential rain. And, you know, he is a very, you know, he's not known for his flat out speed, but he's known for his durability and how often he races. And that obviously, you know, did him well that year. And you can ditto for Des Linden, who won on the women's side. So strength is really, really important. If you're on the cusp of qualifying, I would say, you know, try to find a course that's in your wheelhouse. That could be a flat course. That could be a downhill course. Because one of the things about qualifying for Boston, you can go out west and you can run a Revel downhill course down the side of a mountain and you can qualify for Boston. You might not be prepared for Boston on race day, but you can get in. So I would say find your strength. And, you know, some people prefer to run in very large races where you can feed off the energy of the crowds, New York, Chicago, whatever it might be, London. Some people like quiet races. You know, some of my better earlier races in my, you know, career were on sleepier marathons. I ran my first kind of breakthrough race in Portland, Maine, going up and down the coast with about 800 runners, and I could just focus on Mark, you know. And sometimes you need to just focus on the most important thing. And, you know, it's hard sometimes in a larger race with so many distractions to put the blinders on and just, you know, focus on your strategy and executing it. So the last thing I would say is Boston's course, and you've heard this, everybody's heard this, it's a Rubik's Cube, right? So it's a roller coaster, it's all these different things, it has the hills. You need to study it. You're going to be rewarded if you know that course really, really well. And even better, not just study it, but mimic it in your training, however you can, right? If you're running your long runs and you have 20 miles on your calendar for that day, then you might want to consider hitting mile 15 and saying, okay, I'm really going to, you know, find some hills for miles 16 through 20, just to get the same kind of experience in your training that you're going to have on race day. Because when you hit those hills, if you're racing a marathon, as you know, nobody feels great at mile 16. But it's one thing to feel kind of, you know, a little slightly wrecked, if you will, as you should feel if you're racing all out, and not be prepared for those hills. So you really want to experience them in training as much as you can, even if you live in a relatively flat area like Florida, and it's difficult to find them. Do it on a treadmill, find some bridges, do what you need to do. It's going to come back and reward you.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice, especially when you're talking about studying the course and really getting to know it. That's definitely going to help you on race day have the best possible experience, because I think, you know, like you said, the course is just so variable and hilly, but it's very interesting in the way that it is hilly. And so that, I think, is the Rubik's Cube of Boston that you sort of have to solve if you want to have a really good race there. But just getting there is also such a journey for runners. And your advice to find a course that suits you personally is a really good one. You know, my first marathon was New York City. And, you know, I was a cross-country track athlete in college and, you know, run so many different races. But that was my first marathon. And I was admittedly fatigued from the energy of the crowds. I felt like for, you know, 2 hours and 44 minutes, which it took me to finish that race, I was just being yelled at the entire time. And I didn't love it. I didn't love it. I'm a little bit more maybe of a rhythm runner when it comes to the really longer distances, like a marathon. You know, if I'm on a track racing a mile, okay, I want everyone screaming their heads off. That's a little bit more high intensity.
Right.
But, you know, that just goes to show different people like different things, and different things allow you to race to your potential. So that's a really good point. And, you know, finding a small marathon, a big marathon, a downhill marathon, I think is a great option for runners who need, you know, maybe that extra 4, 5, 6 minutes that they're not going to get on a flatter course. But of course, not everyone can make it out to like a Revel race out here in the West, where you're going to experience, you know, 6,000 feet of elevation loss over the 26.2 miles.
Yeah, that's pretty dreamy, and especially in super shoes, which is nice. But I mean, I find, like you said, you know, some larger marathons, that crowd can take as much energy away from you as it can give you. And a lot of it is what's happening in here. You know, where are you? If you're hurting and you're at mile 21 and somebody's yelling, "You got this, Jason," you just might not be in the headspace to appreciate that comment. They're trying to do you a solid, but if it hits wrong, it's really in here. And I get it. I mean, if you're just in a bad place, sometimes people just doing the nicest things can irritate. but, you know, getting back to Boston, I find that there are some areas where Hell's Alley is one of them, where you go over the overpass of, the interstate. Another one is after you crest Heartbreak Hill, you go back down the back half of that, and you go past the cemetery right around before you hit Cleveland Circle. These are quiet areas of the course, and you really need to kind of get ready for them mentally, because you always hear, "Oh, the crowds are going to give you so much energy." If you hit that dead space and you're not ready for it, then it can be demoralizing, I found. So yeah, there's so many tricks.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk a little bit more about, a runner gets qualified. They have registered for the Boston Marathon. They're in Hopkinton at the Athletes Village. They're waiting to run the race. What is your best advice for someone who maybe has never been to the Athletes Village before? for protecting yourself from the elements, for staying warm, and just having a good experience at the village. Because I feel like if you've never been there, it's a lot to take in.
Correct. So you're literally, you know, if you feel like you're in the Hunger Games, you get off this bus and you're in the middle of nowhere in Hopkinton, and they shepherd you to this school. And it is kind of, it's a little strange. But I will say this. I mean, there's one thing that I would say even before we talk about the Athlete's Village, and I would say, if you can, and you find somebody who has commandeered a house in Hopkinton, because the charity teams all over have houses all over Hopkinton. So, you know, homeowners open up their homes to charity teams and different BAA. If you can find a home where you can be indoors with the proper air conditioning, hanging out on the sofa, that is ideal. You know, going to a real bathroom, right? And it can happen. You just need to know the right people. So I would look into that first. The second thing is, if you can't find somebody that can get you into one of those houses, then Athlete's Village is kind of what you make it. It can be absolutely horrible if the weather is horrible. In 2018, there is nothing you could have done to make your experience good. I will give you a quick story. In 2018, I was wearing, you know, garbage bags all over me and trying to just keep dry. And the wind was so vicious and the rain was so vicious that they literally shredded. So I was completely saturated before the start, as was everybody else. But getting away from, you know, awful experience like 2018, I would say definitely bring garbage bags, whether it's nice weather or bad weather. Garbage bags are so, you know, multifunctional. They can keep you warm. They can keep you dry, at least if it's raining politely. And you can pass a few out to friends. You can obviously get on the wet grass and recline and not get wet. So there's so many things you can do with just the garbage bags. I would bring, you know, many garbage bags with you. Another thing is, if you're racing and you're looking for a BQ or a PR, you really need to think about conserving as much energy as possible, because it is a little overstimulating to be at Athlete's Village amongst all these runners. And the inclination to talk to them and speak to them and get to know people is front and center. You'll feel the need to do that. But if you want to PR, you need to conserve as much energy and just kind of find a quiet place and just find your zen and chill. Not easy to do. Another thing is, make use of the facilities, right? You know, people panic if they don't have a porta potty, and there are plenty of porta potties. Back in the day, you hear horror stories of people that were doing horrible things all over Hopkinton lawns, and the lawns in Hopkinton every spring were the greenest lawns because of that. But that's not a thing anymore. You will find plenty of porta potties, even right next to the start area. You know, there might be a few lines here and there, but you'll, even if you had to at the very last second go and leave your corral, you'll be able to do it and get back into your corral. And even if you can't get back into your corral because of nature's cruelty, you can go to a corral behind you, as long as it's not the first corral in a subsequent wave. So don't stress. Another thing is, just try to remain calm.
Yeah, that's really good advice for pre-race. You're going to be able to quell your anxiety a little bit if you're not freaking out about all those little things. You know, when I ran Boston in 2014, I did struggle a little bit with the porta potty situation. Hopefully things have been made a little bit better over the years, but I think I waited in line for 45 minutes and, you know, was just about to burst. So I would definitely recommend, just in case something like that happens, if you're a guy, maybe bring an empty Powerade bottle or something like that, so that you can discreetly relieve yourself and not have to, water all the lawns in Hopkinton. You don't want to do that.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I was going to say one more thing is actually, you need to get there first, right? So that drive from the Back Bay of Boston all the way out to Hopkinton, after you've been eating all the food and carb loading and, drinking all the fluids you want to drink, and sometimes arguably too many fluids, and holding it on that bus while it's in traffic, with all the nerves you have, that I've seen many, many runners dash off the bus into the woods and never get back on the bus. They have to walk the remaining 3 miles to Hopkinton school. So Yeah, it's tricky, no doubt.
A very good testament just to the importance of managing your bodily functions on Boston Marathon morning. It's a little different with that bus ride, the fact that you're all in, like, you know, the athlete's village, which is a confined space. So just be aware of that and practice some good planning. Now, I did want to ask you something very specific that's in your book that I found interesting. You recommend bringing a sponge. I didn't continue reading to why you may want to bring a sponge. I'd love to hear that.
I have found, and I've run 18 Bostons and 26 marathons altogether. I can honestly say that the most amazing thing that I discovered is the household sponge. So it can do a lot of things. I mean, number one, if it's a warm day, absolutely bring the sponge, because you can just put it in the water that they give you at the, you know, water stations, and just, you know, hit yourself, your pressure points. They don't hand out ice on the course at Boston, but kids all over, if it's a warm day, warmish day, kids along the course will be handing out ice. If you cut a slit in the sponge, if it's one of those maybe car wash type sponges, then you can carve a slit in it and you can put the ice in it, and then it holds it. And then you can just keep reapplying liberally throughout the entire duration of the race. It's even better than getting a mist machine or a douse of water over the head, because the water is warm anyway. So this is, it's a sponge is dreamy.
Mark, this is innovative. I have been running for so long. I don't want to say more than a quarter century, but it has been that long. And I have never heard of this strategy. This is brilliant. This is such a unique way to keep yourself cool. You know, maybe get a little extra water in your mouth, which is going to help with hydration. This is great.
I mean, and if it's not needed in the moment, it's a sponge. You wring it out and put it in your waistband and you're good. It's not going to, it weighs, you know, I remember Ryan Hall used to weigh his shoelaces. So, you know, people who are that hyper concerned, the sponge doesn't weigh much, right? It's easy to carry.
I love it. Okay. So now the gun goes off and we have to think about actually racing the Boston Marathon. Now it gets difficult because of the course, because of the way that the course is structured. And I always think, you know, whoever designed the Boston Marathon course, like, wanted this to be a slower, kind of grueling course for runners. But do you think about chunking the course into certain segments to help you better grapple with the distance? And how do you think about, you know, the beginning, the middle, the end? Like, how many different segments do you think about when you think about the Boston course? How do we wrap our minds around that?
Yeah, great question. So I always, let's get away from Boston for a hot second. And I'll tell you the way I see a typical marathon, let's just call it, let's say a Chicago flat marathon, is to look at three C's, I call them. The first is conserve, the second is cruise, and the third is to compete. Now, the way I break it down on a flat course would be the first 10 miles, you want to conserve as much energy as possible. And by conserve, I don't just mean physical energy. I mean mental, emotional. You really just want to not focus on your pace. You want to be close to your goal pace, but you can't be too hyper-concerned about it. You really just want to think about everything that you're doing in those first 10 miles. You're conserving energy. That's what you should be thinking about. The second stage, the second 10 miles, would be the cruise stage. And at that point, what you want to do is absolutely lock into your goal time. You want to be on autopilot, like you're a pilot having a cappuccino at 30,000 feet, right? You're just ripping, and it should feel, again, almost machine-like. If you hit 20 miles and you've conserved the first 10 and you've cruised through the second 10, and there you are at 20, and it's a flat course, then you're ready to compete, because there you are in the last 10K, and you should be in far better shape than the other people that haven't done those first two segments properly. And it's at that point where you're really going to dig in. That's where you're going to exert energy, mental, physical, emotional, everything. You're going to just let it all out. And what you're going to do is you're going to keep ratcheting up that energy, almost like it's a crescendo, if you will, all the way to the finish. And that's a perfect marathon to me. So at Boston, it's different, and it's really because of the course. So I look at four C's. Three of them are the same, but there's one different one. So the first 6 miles, which are relatively downhill, gets you to roughly around Framingham. That's downhill, and you're truly going to conserve for those first 6 miles. From 7 to 15 is where you're going to cruise. And it's relatively, sure, there are rollers, but it's relatively flat-ish, as flat as Boston gets from 7 to 15. And you want to have that mentality. You want to be absolutely in that autopilot, clipping off the miles, find some people to work with in those miles that are running the same pace, stay in a little group, work together, but just cruise. Then what's different about Boston is you hit mile 16, you start going up the Newton Hills from 16 to 21. It's there where the fourth C comes into play. That's control. You need to control your effort. You need to throw out the cruise. I need to hit this certain number on every mile. And you need to start thinking about how much effort am I expending to get up these hills? And you need to think about it that way. Because you don't want to get up to the top of Heartbreak Hill at mile 21 and be wrecked. Because Boston's course, as you know from running 2014, if you, you know, ration your energy properly and get to the top of Heartbreak Hill, the final 5 miles are fast. If I took you fully tapered and trained and you just could run those last 5 miles, you would rip it. Anybody would. They really would. It's a gorgeous...
I'm thinking about it.
I mean, it's a fast stretch, but it's not fast if you're completely, you know, depleted and bonking and wrecked. So once you get through that control phase, we get to the top of Heartbreak Hill, then you re-enter the compete phase. And that's where in Boston, yeah, you see damage in other marathons where people look like zombies and they're doing the zombie shuffle and walking and that kind of thing. At Boston, I've never seen at any other marathon quite the carnage that you see in the last 5 miles at Boston, just because it beats you up so much. So to avoid that, you need to get the first three segments right, you need to get the control segment right, and then you're ready to compete. And you should be passing, if you just don't slow down and you're maintaining that goal pace, you will pass, well, depending on how fast you are, hundreds or thousands of runners in your last 5 miles.
I spent a lot of my years working at the Prudential Tower in Boston.
Okay.
And so I would literally go out the building and be right there on Boylston. So I spectated a lot of Boston marathons right at the corner of Boylston and Hereford. And I will speak to the carnage that is the Boston Marathon. If you are not prepared for the distance, for the unique type of course that it is, you can go to the finish line and really just witness a lot of human carnage. It's just people shuffling with that zombie walk. It's not the most inspiring sight. You got to go closer to the finish line to see people actually celebrating, to be truly inspired. But let's get back to this chunking idea, because I think the way that you have labeled each of these four sections is incredibly helpful. And it sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, that the cruise section of the race, you know, roughly miles, you know, 7 through 15, that's more about hitting your target pace that you're trying to go after. But then when you hit mile 16 and you're getting after, you know, the Newton Hills, and it's more about control, it's much more about effort at that point. And that to me says runners have to be comfortable with both metrics in their training ahead of time. You need to be good at executing your goal pace, but also really good at executing what feels like marathon pace, depending on the terrain.
Yes, that's well said. Yeah, it's not easy, especially if you've done a lot of your training on some flatter ground and you're used to just being that metronome. Right? Because you kind of have to throw the metronome out for a second. And I'm not going to say, you know, obviously Kipchoge is Kipchoge. But Kipchoge started to break down his only Boston Marathon last year, you know, in the hills. And, you know, you think, well, Kipchoge, the greatest of all time, is fantastic on the flats. And that kind of got him. And it's, you know, I'm certain he had plenty of hills in his training, but it is interesting how you need to really, really control that effort to be able to run down the backside of Heartbreak Hill and have that momentum that you have in your legs strong enough to run that last 5 miles quickly. It's yeah.
Yeah. And I'm going to put on my coach's hat for a second. When I am coaching runners for Boston, I like to have them do goal marathon pace running in a lot of different contexts, because I think it's helpful to allow runners to learn marathon pace and marathon effort. So for example, you know, I might have runners run their marathon pace at the end of a 20 miler, which is going to feel very different than if they were running it, you know, a goal marathon pace workout on a random Tuesday when they might only be doing 8 miles total. They're going to feel a lot fresher. That marathon pace is going to feel a lot easier. And then, of course, if you actually live in the area, running some marathon pace workouts on the course and with the instruction to actually run it by effort, to try to not really pay too much attention to the pace when you're on the Newton Hills, but just get a sense of the rhythm of what marathon pace feels like, I think can be really helpful for anybody who really wants to master this course.
Yes, yes. It's, yeah, I mean, a lot of practice to make that happen. I mean, I think there are, Scott Fobel is one of them who can just, you know, makes it what you just described look easy. And he's had great success at Boston. You know, the other thing about Boston that we haven't talked about yet is the different climates that exist. So, you know, you hit those Newton Hills, and it's when you get to the top of Heartbreak Hill that you begin to go your toward the Back Bay. I can tell you, as you lived in the area too, it could be snowing in Hopkinton, and it could be 28 degrees, and in the Back Bay, it could be 47 and politely raining. So it's a different climate. So when you come over that hill, talking about controlling your effort, you know, you really need to think that, what am I going to hit? And sometimes you hit a headwind that didn't exist in Hopkinton or Wellesley. So it's tricky in the weather sense. Even if you are controlling your effort, it throws you these curveballs that you need to see coming, or at least be able to recognize as you're doing your weather stalking.
You know, this is like the hardest marathon to get right if you really want to run a good marathon. Let's talk a little bit about something fun that you put in your book. You have a list of the 10 commandments of Boston Marathon etiquette. Now, we don't need to go through all 10 of these commandments. Folks should definitely check out your book. But what do you think are some of the most important etiquette rules, quote unquote, rules there are at Boston?
Wow. Okay. That section, I inject a lot of humor in the book, reverent humor. I mean, there's nobody that loves the marathon more than I do. And it's not humor for humor's sake, if you will. But I do have, you know, so one example is, and I would say that's important, is number six, commandment number six, if you will. Thou shalt not covet thy fellow runner's wave, bib number, PR, BQ, gear, mileage, medals, calves, or anything else.
Calves.
And what I'm saying here is, you know, if you're running that sleepy marathon that I described in Portland, Maine, and you're kind of in your own zone doing your thing, you can just focus on you and execute your plan. At Boston, you just have all these distractions, and especially because there you are after your journey is complete to get there in the corral, and you're looking around and you're having all these doubts like, oh, I'm not wearing the latest super shoe like he is, or wow, that person looks a lot faster than I look. You know, so you start having these doubts creep in and coveting, you know, what somebody is doing pre-race and even during the race. Or maybe you're in Framingham, where I describe these cruise miles, and you're on your goal pace and you're just doing your thing. And you have this pack of runners pass you, and you're thinking to yourself, I should follow them. I feel good. I'll just go with them. But you can't do that. You really constantly need to remind yourself of your own race and what you have planned for that race and your fitness level and what you think you can pull off and not get pulled in. It's kind of like the same thing you described with the beginning of the race in Hopkinton. It's the steepest downhill, and it's just so tempting. You know, Boston lulls you in to going fast those first 6 miles. And you need to constantly remind yourself, constantly, conserve. Don't zigzag around other runners. Don't expend energy. Just stay in your little zone. So, yeah, that's a biggie.
I'm glad that you brought that up, Mark, because like this is the comparison trap to me. You know, this is one of the easiest ways to undermine your race, which is to throw out your plan in favor of what someone else is doing on race day because it looks sexier, more exciting. It looks more effective, but you have no idea if they're actually doing the right thing. You have no idea if they're doing the right thing, but it's right for them and not right for you. So that's really important. And I would say, you know, let's use Shalane Flanagan's mantra of cold execution on Boston Marathon race day. And that really means cold execution of your plan. Don't let anybody else's plan throw you off.
Yeah, it's a great, great thing to remember because, again, it's almost like over and over and over again, you're going to be tempted so many times, you know, wherever in the course it may be, whatever runners might pass you, and they may even egg you on. They may say, hey, come with us, you know, and you're like, no. Yeah, so you have to constantly say if that happens that you're going to see them again. And when you see them again, you're going to be the one passing them. And that the race doesn't finish in Framingham. It finishes in the Back Bay. And there's a lot of race left. So, but you have to remind yourself. And if you don't, one of those little temptations might just get you. So, yeah, absolutely. A second one I'll highlight is commandment number 10, which is a pretty simple one. Thou shalt curse the weather. So, you know, Boston is known, right, for its weather, right? It's front and center in this great race because it's a tricky time of year. And if you look at the history of weather for the Boston Marathon, I pulled it up in my little research. I think it averages from 42 to 55, which is kind of dreamy conditions. Not to mention that on any given day, you should have prevailing westerlies, which work to our favor, right? So, you know, we start in Hopkinton and we run east. So a prevailing westerly is going to help us. And you have those magical days like 2011 when Ryan Hall ran 204 and Jeffrey Mutai ran 203 and to win the race and set the record, or at the time the record. But that was, you know, 2011 and 1975 when Bill Rogers ran 209.55 and stopped to tie his shoe multiple times. Perfect weather. So that happens like 4% of the time. The other 96% of the time, it's very, very tricky. And the level of trickiness depends. But, you know, 2018 was an absolute mess with the 30-mile-an-hour headwinds and the rain and the cold and the hypothermia. But we also had 2012 where it was 80 some degrees, 2004 where it was over 80 degrees. Jack Foltz, who wrote the foreword for the book, ran and won in 1976 when it was 100 degrees in Hopkinton. But at the finish line, it was 68. So you get an idea of how incredibly different it can be as you work your way from town to town, how that weather can change. So you're allowed to curse it. You have a bib on your chest. By all means, have at it. But at the same time, study it. You know, really, as the race nears, don't get too obsessed with it. But you really do need to know, like, what is it going to be like in the morning when I'm in Hopkinton, in Athletes Village, you know, in the wind? Is it raining? How cold am I going to be? How can I keep myself warm? I mean, your body, to maintain its warmth, uses energy, right? So if you're not warm and you're shivering, then you're blowing energy that you will need in the Newton Hills. Conversely, if it's incredibly hot and you're just chilling out, getting a suntan because you're so pale and you want to get a little sun, that's not a good idea either. Curse the weather.
Fun story, Mark. With my first marathon at New York City in 2008, you know, they bus you over to Staten Island and you're there for about an hour and a half before the race starts. There were so many porta potties on Staten Island that hundreds of them got used zero times. And it was so cold, and I was not quite prepared for that cold weather. I spent about 45 minutes just hanging out in a porta potty because I didn't want to be shivering, because that was sort of my, you know, my threshold for when I really needed to go into a porta potty to spend some time just staying warm, because I can't be shivering, because then you're just burning through your glycogen stores. And with all the work that we do to carb load, let's not get through another 30 grams of carbohydrate or whatever it might be in the hour before the race starts, because you're so cold. So a big thank you to the New York City Marathon race directors for all their porta potties. So clean. I didn't even mind hanging out with them for so long.
I think that's crafty. That's I'm going to have to remember that for, but you know, it's funny, not New York, but Boston, when I first ran it, I think it was 2006 when it changed, it used to be a noon start. So you waited, you'd get out to Hopkinton at 7 a.m. and you would wait until noon. And if you were running for a charity, you didn't have waves. So if you ran for charity, you were in the way, way back. You wouldn't even cross the starting line until 12:45, 1 o'clock, and you had been out there since 7. So it's a little bit better nowadays, but it's still something that you need to prepare for and really study the weather to make sure you get it right, or at least as right as you can.
One thing that you keep saying is studying the course, the weather, everything that Boston is going to throw at you is going to give you a real advantage on race day. And I just want to highlight that, because I think that is, you know, the worth of this podcast, and, you know, probably why folks should pick up your book, is because the more you know about the Boston course, the better you're going to be at executing on it. It is a unique course. It is uniquely difficult. And figuring that out, solving that Rubik's Cube, like you keep saying, is going to be a big determinant of your success. Let's talk a little bit about the end of the race. Okay, so you cross the finish line. You've done it. You've mastered the Boston Marathon. Hopefully it went well for you. Now, as a coach, I am like super adamant about marathon recovery. I think a lot of things should be done on that day to really, you know, kickstart the recovery process. How do you think folks can take advantage of the finisher's area to get the most out of it? You know, like, where's the food? How do you get your stuff as quickly as possible? And, you know, then can go and sit down. Like, I want runners to have a plan for after the race, just like they do for the race itself.
Yeah. Boston is slightly unique in that. So first things first, when you're on Boylston Street and you've got that, whatever, 600, you know, meters of amazingness, take it all in, enjoy it. Once you cross that finish line, you'll be euphoric. Be mindful of the runners coming in behind you. However, don't, you know, you can get your photos and that kind of thing, but you kind of need to, Boston's really good about keeping you moving. So runners, when they cross, will be encouraged by many, many a volunteer to just keep moving. And that's good. So, you know, unlike, say Chicago, where you cross the finish line and you can kind of find your way to Grant Park and just kind of chill, Boston, kind of leads you down Boylston Street to your immediate right. Once you finish, if you're feeling disoriented, wonky in any way beyond the usual, right to your right is the medical tent, massive medical tent with all the, you know, top hospitals in Boston to help you. So don't be shy about going, taking an immediate right into the medical tent. That's number one. Number two, keep kind of moving forward, as everybody's going to encourage you to do. And the food is a little bit further down the road than you'd want it to be. But I don't know about you, but the last thing I want after I finished a marathon, I find it difficult to drink Gatorade because it's so sweet. And the first thing they offer you is Gatorade, and I really want to take it and just throw it. but they will offer you Gatorade and water immediately, which is nice. There will be a lot of photographers around you that will, you know, take your salt stained picture, which is also a positive. But you're just going to continue to walk down Boylston Street, and you have to go multiple blocks before you can turn left or right. You're kind of in this, you know, gated area where you'll get your medal. You'll have a bag of goodies that they'll give you, banana, bagel, whatever, chips and that kind of thing, which is nice. And then, and eventually you're going to be shepherded down further to the point where you have to turn left or right, and you turn right to go get your warm, dry clothes that you had put in the bus waiting for you. And you go over and you can then change your clothes, especially on those horrible weather days. That's nice to have it so close. And I kind of like the way that Boston, there's not a lot of place to kind of mill about. You can leave that Boylston Street area. You can go left to Newbury Street. You can go right deeper into the Back Bay and South End. But they really do encourage you to get the heck out of there, out of Copley Square. And I say that in a good way, because you really should move on with your day. Boston's fantastic, and there's so much to do after the race. Why walk around salt stained and, you know, all beat up when you can go get a nice shower at your hotel or, you know, and so many amazing restaurants in the area. Go get yourself a nice good meal to start the recovery. But I think, to your point, you know, the good news is you will have some food items to kind of replenish straight away. You will continue to walk, which is good. You will have some things to navigate, like curbs, which seem like mountains. you know, you've run the Boston Marathon when you look at a curb and you're like, no, I'm going to walk a little bit further and go where there isn't a curb. Because your quads are so wrecked. In the old day, when the chips weren't on the back of your bib, they were on your shoelace, and you were so messed up that you couldn't go down and take it off your shoe. So volunteers would literally take it off your shoelaces. That's changed, which is good. Yeah, no, it's, you know, I think, again, it gets back to the weather. You know, if it's a beautiful day, I mean, you could take that right-hand turn, go get your dry stuff and go down the Newbury Street and chill. I know some people who finish go straight to Tracksmith. There's actually a competition within a competition. Are you familiar with that?
I don't think I am, no.
Okay, so Tracksmith has this thing, first to the track house. So the first male and first female that finish the Boston Marathon and get to the track house, which is at 285 Newbury Street, are rewarded with a trophy that Bobby Gibb actually sculpted, and a robe, and I think a beer is involved, but it's literally the woman who won last year didn't even get her medal because she was so concerned about being first to the track house that she jumped over barricades and ran to the track house and ended up being a winner.
That's so funny to me. I love how Boston sort of makes the recovery process a little bit easier just by, you know, having the medical tent right there just in case. But then in keeping you moving, you know, I struggled with New York City just because they keep you moving for a little too long, in my opinion. You have to walk like through Central Park, and that to me, it seemed like 10 miles. I'm sure it's a little bit shorter than that. But in my post-marathon brain, my perception of it was certainly a lot longer. But I'm with you on the aversion to sweets after a marathon. You know, I ran the Philadelphia Marathon and they had soup after the race, and it was a little colder on that day. And for some reason that really, really, was exactly what I wanted and needed at the time. So know what you want after a marathon. Maybe it is, you know, something sweet, something to start restocking those glycogen stores, but it also might be something warm, something salty. You know, I think the day of a marathon is when, you know, your good nutrition guidelines can sort of be thrown out the window a little bit. You can get back on track the next day. Reward yourself with whatever your body desires or craves that day, because I think that's probably the number one recovery tool at your disposal, is eating as much as you can after the race to start the muscle rebuilding process, to restock those glycogen stores. And then if you can, you know, I always say try to take a nap. I know it's a little hard, you're jazzed up, but if you can go back to the hotel and take a shower and, you know, lie down for 30 to 60 minutes before you go out to dinner, you are going to feel so much better in the days ahead.
Absolutely. It's interesting you say the soup thing. So a little bit of Boston Marathon history. So way back when, you know, even when Bill Rogers won in that era, the winners, they wouldn't get, well, the winner would get a medal, but the finishers wouldn't get medals. basically the only thing that you got when you finished the Boston Marathon is you would go get a bowl of beef stew. It was legendary. That for decades, that was it. You crossed the finish line, no medal, beef stew. Boom. So things have changed, but they were kind of onto something because that on a cold day would hit right. Much better than another Gatorade.
Yeah. Beef stew actually sounds fantastic to me. I think I'd prefer it.
Yeah.
All right. Last question, Mark. You are able to put a giant billboard in Hopkinton that every Boston Marathoner is going to see before the race starts. What does it say?
Oh, wow. I love that question. It goes so many different directions on this one. I would say my billboard in Hopkinton for every runner to see would say, don't let your pursuit of a good time get in the way of having a good time. That's what I would say. Because Boston, you know, you may have run a 3:30 to qualify in Chicago, and there you are in Boston, and you're in Newton, and you're doing the math, your wonky math, and you realize that that PR is out the window, and you can get really, really negative and spiral. You need to have multiple goals, you know, your A, B, and C goal. And even if your C goal is out the window, you need to kind of keep the joy front and center. So my billboard would say, you know, don't let your pursuit of a good time, as in chronological time, take away from having a good time.
I love that. That is both great advice and also poetic. Brilliant.
Well, I am a writer, so it's getting on.
Yes, you are. Well, Mark, thank you so much for talking some shop about Boston Marathon. It holds such a special place in my mind as a Boston native, as someone who, you know, really wanted to run it in 2014 in solidarity with the running community after, you know, the bombings in 2013. I've spectated so many times. I've coached so many runners to it. It is something, it's one of the best days of the year. You know, I think anyone who's run Boston or is a huge running nerd, Patriots Day is like a federal holiday, or we think it should be. So I love talking about Boston, and with you getting ready for your 19th and writing, you know, your book, the Boston Marathon Handbook, I just think your perspectives are invaluable. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor. And are we going to see you in Hopkinton one of these years? Is that a plan or?
Maybe. I'm not sure if my marathon days are behind me. I do really have a soft spot for middle distances. You know, I'm a cross country track guy. You know, I love like 5K, 8K, the mile, those kinds of distances. But, you know, they get a little bit more difficult to race with age. So I might move up in distance and stick with those. We'll see.
Understood. We'll have to talk strength training. I've got plenty to talk about there. I'm a former college baseball player turned runner. So trying to make the two of them, you know, marry them, the strength training and the running. And it's just, haven't gotten it right yet. So we'll figure it out.
Yeah, it's a big part of it. And like you said, I think the Boston course lends itself to runners who have a little bit more strength and can utilize that on the race course. So yeah, that would be a good discussion for perhaps round number two.
There you go. Awesome. Appreciate it, Jason.
Thank you. And that's our show. Thank you for listening. If you're a fan of my work here on the podcast and this conversation itself, please consider leaving a review or supporting our sponsors. By using their links and discount codes, you are supporting the Strength Running Podcast and indicating to them that they should continue advertising on the show. First, let's get yourself some free electrolytes. Our sponsor, Element, is offering a free gift with your purchase at drinklmnt.com/strengthrunning. And this doesn't have to be your first purchase. You're going to get a sample pack with every flavor so you can try them all before deciding what you like best. Now, if you're not familiar, Element is my favorite way to hydrate. I love the citrus flavor, the watermelon flavor. I am giving this stuff out all the time and personally using it almost on a daily basis. And they make electrolytes for athletes like us and low-carb folks with no sugar, no artificial ingredients or colors. And it can be a really helpful way to prevent dehydration when you're running long or if you're running a very hard workout. If you sometimes feel
a little bit too tired, or you're getting headaches, cramps, or sleeplessness after long runs or workouts, you might have an electrolyte imbalance or deficiency that needs to be addressed. Boost your performance and your recovery, especially in the heat, with Element. They're the exclusive hydration partner to Team USA Weightlifting, and quite a few professional baseball, hockey, and basketball teams are on regular subscriptions. Plus, Element is my go-to morning beverage if I've gone to one of Denver's many breweries the night before, and I want my morning to feel a little smoother. Check them out at drinklmnt.com/strengthrunning to get your free sample pack gift with your purchase, and you'll get your hydration optimized for the upcoming season. Finally, get yourself 15% off your first purchase at Prevenex.com with code Jason15. Prevenex is a unique supplement company that holds itself to standards that the rest of the industry doesn't. And they're celebrating the release of Muscle Health Plus, which is a unique combination of amino acids, creatine, and ingredients that aid protein synthesis and the absorption of those amino acids. This is your anti-soreness supplement. It's going to help you prevent muscle damage, which is particularly important for aging runners who want to protect themselves from muscle loss and recover faster after hard workouts. And as is true for all of their products, Prevenex adheres to the highest of standards. Their ingredients are clinically proven to do what they say they're going to do. So yes, Muscle Health Plus has ingredients that are clinically proven to improve protein synthesis and the absorption of amino acids, critical for helping promote lean muscle mass, strength, recovery, and better body composition. I have been consistently impressed with all of their supplements and how committed they are to transparent, clinically proven ingredients. From Joint Health Plus to Nourify, Immune Support, and now Muscle Health Plus, Prevenex has you covered no matter your needs. Melissa just used our discount code and she wrote, "I started taking the Joint Health Plus first, and after years and years of taking glucosamine, I actually feel a difference with this. Now I'm using the Muscle Health Plus supplement, and it seems to help me recover faster. Being new to this type of supplement, I'm looking forward to seeing how it helps with strength training." Amazing, Melissa. Best of luck, and thank you. Get yourself 15% off your first Prevenex purchase by using code Jason15 at checkout. Visit Prevenex.com. That's Prevenex.com. And just remember, they offer a 30-day money-back guarantee where if you don't feel the benefits on their product, you get your money back, no questions asked. All right, that's the show, my friends. Thank you for listening. Thanks for being part of this community. And thank you for being so passionate about this sport. We'll talk soon.